question and answer session from the post-plenary press conference held at the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales on Friday, the 15th of November, 2013. The panel, Claire Ward, Home Mission Desk, Monsignor Marcus Stock, General Secretary of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, Archbishop Vincent Nichols, Archbishop of Westminster and President of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, and Elizabeth Davis, Project Officer for the Marriage and Family Life Office. The assembled journalists asked a number of questions, and because the audio is difficult to hear when the journalists ask questions, there may be a dubbed-over version of the question here, and obviously you'll hear the answer from the panel. The first question related to admissions to Catholic schools. It was, when there's a call for dioceses to resist any pressure to impose a 50% cap on places, does that amount to saying there will be no more Catholic academies unless the policy changes?
We have great reservations about the upfront presentation of the policy on academies. And that is a matter of regret for us, because we believe, you know, that those Catholic academies that are established actually deliver a very good education and are among the best of the academies. Now, they're academies that have taken over from existing Catholic schools. So really what we want to explore much more with the government is why cannot that success also be offered to a new academy without this 50% cap on admissions.
Right. On television this morning, you were talking about the issues I was going to ask about.
Okay, fine. Yeah.
And that was about the liberal views of Catholics on certain teachings of the church compared to those teachings. And that was really...
Okay.
Especially on the gay issues and on the other issues around sexual teachings.
Okay. So this is in the context then of the questionnaire that's been circulated in preparation for the Synod.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. I think what this moment is reflective upon is the great respect that Pope Francis shows to people. And you can see that in the way he greets individuals. You can see it in the way he speaks of people and his kind of abiding belief in their goodness and in their desire to lead a good life. And it's out of that respect that he, in a way that I've not seen before, has created this urgency to listen. Now, I think what he wants us to listen to is the experience of people. So it's the experience of their desiring to live a Christian life in a context and in a set of assumptions, which is not always very easy. If I could put it like this. You know, Christian life invites us to have high aspirations and high expectations. Now, they are often deeply embedded in human nature. So, you know, most people want a happy marriage. Well, most people want a stable family life. Most people want to be able to bring up their children in a context of love and stability. And yet, the reality that we live is messy and it's ambivalent. And it's pockmarked with failure and disappointment. And what lies in between those two things is that it's something that is so important to the Pope, which is the notion of mercy. So what he's asking us to do is to, on the one hand, see how well understood, accepted is the vision of humanity that Christ gives us. And on the other hand, respond with great compassion and accompaniment to the reality of the situation, and to understand that in between those two is this pool of God's mercy. I was always brought up to understand the Catholic Church as a church of sinners, a church that spends more of its time on its knees, a church in which we learn to rely on God's mercy, not on my goodness. And I think if you look at that questionnaire, the word that appears most often is pastoral. And that word means, how do we live this tension? And how does a priest, how does a parent accompany those in their care through all the difficulties of life? And we've got a lot to learn about that. There's a long tradition of pastoral care in the church, and I think Pope Francis is very clear it needs to be refreshed. And one way from which it is refreshed is by listening very attentively to people's struggles, to their experience, to their deepest desires, and to their disappointments as well.
Question. Isn't it true, though, Archbishop, that people aren't just going wrong because they are making mistakes in their lives as Catholics, but they're choosing, on the basis of their own moral judgments, to go a different way from the Church, and that's the dilemma the Church really faces?
I think, again, slightly to repeat, what these questions are designed for is to help people to share their experience. Now, if their experience leads them to this conclusion or that conclusion, that's what we listen to. And listening is very, very important. As I said in the radio this morning, you know, God gave us one mouth, but two ears. So we should not be worried about what we're going to hear, not be put off or timid or somehow afraid that we might hear things that are uncomfortable. That's no problem. But the challenge is not the challenge of the process whereby, you know, a survey leads to a reshaping of a policy that a government then puts into legislation. Because that's the business of the state. The business of the state, through that process, is to help us to live together as good citizens. So the state properly and the political process properly looks for where public opinion is and where it's going. But that's not the business of the church. The business of the church is to try and help us all to live faithfully to the teachings of Christ. So this is not a process that is in any way closely linked to all those things we normally associate with surveys, which is a survey, a clarification of opinion, the identification of trends, and therefore the shaping of policy to fit those trends. That's not what we're doing. What we're doing is trying to understand more deeply the fundamental tension and challenge of trying to live a faithful Christian life in our society, in Africa, in the Philippines, in wherever. And all of this will, at the Pope's request, will be handled by the Extraordinary Synod next October, whose task is to try and understand at depth the situation and the challenges before us. And then there's another year's reflection. And then in October 2015, there is a synod to look at what action is the consequence of this period of reflection, study and listening.
What could the consequence be in terms of policy and changes in the Church's approach to people who fall short of the ideals it puts forward?
Well, I mean, again, I think the word policy slips in very easily but inappropriately, because the Church in a way doesn't have policies. It has teachings and it has a long tradition of pastoral accompaniment or pastoral care. And I think we've got a lot to learn. And I think what I would expect is development of that long tradition of pastoral care, which in a way has diminished a bit as a practical tradition in the Church. It's diminished a bit, say, in the last 30, 40 years, when we've been very, very tied up with ideas and notions. But the hard work that most priests spend their time doing is accompanying people through difficult situations and walking with them. I think Pope Francis gives a wonderful image of what he's talking about in his use of the story of the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. If you remember that story, the disciples are walking away from Jerusalem, Jerusalem standing for the church. And Pope Francis says, many people are walking away from the church today. They are downcast in their spirits, they're disappointed, they're walking away. What is our job? Our job is to go and walk alongside them. And that's the revival, if you like, of the best, of the pastoral practice of the church that he wants to see.
The next question, if when walking alongside those people, a priest finds that their life is not in keeping within the teaching of the Church, is the intention to get them back within the teaching of the Church or just to continue to walk alongside them?
Well, you know, he uses you're quite right. He uses the narrative of the two disciples in precisely that way. I mean, what Jesus didn't say to them is, now turn around and get back to Jerusalem and get back to where you should be. He walks with them. And through that accompaniment, there comes that moment when the two people recognize in their lives the presence of God and the working of grace. And it's that which makes them want to go back to Jerusalem. So I think unfolding that story, it is to look for the moments of grace, to recognize them more, to, as it were, be more sensitive to that mercy of God, which is always operative in our lives, rather than simply to look to ask simple questions about conformity to norms at every step of the way.
Is that a polite way of saying that the church needs to be less condemning of people, even if it doesn't change its teaching?
Well, I think that will be one of the most interesting aspects of the responses we get from the questionnaire. And I wouldn't, at this point, wish to guess where the balance of those things will lie. There are certainly public voices that readily say that the church is very condemning. I'm not sure that's the experience of lots of people, actually. The priests I know who do this pastoral work, the teachers I know, the parents I know, you know, are very pastoral and caring and always want the work of love to come out as the strongest thing they offer.
Archbishop Vincent, you just mentioned the parish priests effectively in their pastoral work, which I'm sure many of us would recognise. However, there are messages coming from higher up in the Catholic Church which I think many people would find confusing and therefore would wonder where we're going with some of the issues that are going to be covered in the survey. For example, Pope Francis, as you've mentioned, talks continually about mercy. Archbishop Muller, head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, has said that there can be no mercy when it comes to whether divorced and remarried Catholics can receive communion. So that sends out very confusing signals to many people. So I therefore wonder what you think of those confusing signals and what sense you make of them, but also what does this tell us about this survey? Will we just continue to have confusing signals? So we'll have some mercy in saying to people, we understand you have a problem, but there will be no solution to a problem such as divorced and remarried Catholics wishing to be part of the church by receiving communion.
I think that there have always been tensions around that point. And I think it's precisely that line of reflection that Pope Francis wants us to explore in much greater depth. So he has spoken of a renewed sense of the pastoral care of marriage and family life. And, for example, one dimension of that might be to reflect much more deeply on how widely understood the fundamental Catholic notion of mutual consent to a permanent bond as the heart of marriage is really understood by everybody who enters marriage. So he's asking us, I think, to look right across the whole scope of the experience of marriage, of our understanding it from the tradition of the church, and of our pastoral response. And if there are two cardinals at the moment who seem to be locking horns, well, maybe that's just a sign that this is going to be a very, very interesting and hopefully fruitful time in the life of the church.
The next question related to criticisms of the so-called survey from the Holy See put online by the Bishops' Conference. Have the bishops talked about the shortcomings of the survey, and what other ways are they hoping to use to get opinion from Catholics ahead of the synod?
Now, I don't think the Holy See in its documentations use the word survey. So, I mean, to immediately put it in the context
of a professional survey which is focused around a certain theme or a certain point and is trying to determine public opinion is not to compare like to like. But I think Elizabeth probably knows more about how people are reacting to it and what kind of measure of response we're getting. And Elizabeth, would you?
Well, clearly the questions, as you know, are long and complex questions. But people are responding very well in great numbers to them. Clearly what we're seeing online is people coming in just to have a look at them, maybe downloading them and going away and coming back, having had time to think. Because it does take a good period of time to answer this this consultation document. But people are responding. We're getting good numbers at the moment. We're certainly already more than 15,000 have accessed the online survey. I have no means of knowing how many people have responded through Diocese. But I think people are coping very well with them. And they're certainly the right questions to be asking at this moment.
Follow-up question. How many responses have you had so far, or is it impossible to tell?
It is actually impossible simply because of the way that SurveyMonkey measures complete responses. So you actually have to go through, but what you have to realise, it's very fluid. Immediately it gets a lot of publicity, a lot of people go on, and actual response rate seems to fluctuate. I think we went sort of a bit viral on the 31st of October, so it took a week for the figures to kind of come down to where people were really logging on to fill the response. But I think it's about a third at the moment are actually really answering, you know, and they don't have to answer all the questions. So it's at least a third who are contributing something through this process.
Could I just add 2 points to that? I did have a look at... There's one question, or the introduction, where people are asked to identify things about themselves, including their age. Now, the last bit of info I got was that 11,500 people have answered that question about their age. And it's quite interesting. It's 32% are under 35, 42% are between 35 and 65, 16% are over 65, and there are 58 responses so far from people over 85 years of age. So the idea that this is beyond the reach of the vast majority of people isn't borne out, at least by that early indication. And the second point I'd like to make is the online survey is only one of a number of ways in which this is accessible. It's also accessible, as Elizabeth said, as an email method. And it's also people can write in. And I've heard today, for example, of a whole number of Catholic schools who are organising to do this both among the pupils and among the families associated with the school. And I think Elizabeth is also looking to particular groups of people, like your marriage and family coordinators, who have got an in-depth appreciation to elicit a kind of coordinated response from them as well. So there's a many, many different ways of sharing experience. The online monkey is only one.
I'd like to ask you about the statement on poverty.
Yeah.
And it's very shocking that a bishop should talk about the fact that people are destitute, which gives you some indication of how some people are suffering. Is this something that you wish to raise, for example, with the Prime Minister? And make the church's feelings known about the conditions in which some people are living.
I don't think I'd tell the Prime Minister anything he doesn't know. I think what we have two ways of acting. One is through the voice of our Caritas Social Action Network, which has regular contacts with MPs and key ministers. And that is a pathway that we use all the time. And I'm sure use will be made of this particular statement. And the second is summed up, if you like, in the fourth paragraph, which is a very, very brief summary of the work that's going on. And I think that is the necessary partner to
to making statements and to make the creating some political pressure. It's, in fact, in my view, it's more important to be out on the streets and to be helping in the ways that are listed there. And in Westminster Diocese, we're tending to concentrate on three particular projects. One is in conjunction with a major trust called Magic Breakfast. And, you know, the founder of that trust, who is a Catholic woman, will tell you, you know, that one in four children on average are turning up in school hungry. And our efforts to respond to that in partnership with them by providing a simple, nutritious breakfast is aimed not just at their hunger, but at their capacity for learning in the rest of the day. A second initiative is the food banks, which are established in one or two key areas around, well, more than one or two, quite a number of key areas. And we're trying to complement those with a system of vouchers that can be given to parents to allow them to get necessary things from high street stores. Because food banks only deal with non-perishable foodstuffs, and families in poverty have other needs as well. And we're trying to develop a line whereby, you know, it respects a family's dignity, where they can get a voucher to go to a shop and to get what they need, maybe hygienic things and matters like that. And then the third major initiative which we're focusing on is the solitude and loneliness of many old people. And we're working with a charity called Caring for the Aged, and using our parishes as bases for volunteers, because the unique thing about this particular charity is what they try to do is not just bring isolated elderly people to a common place like a school or a church hall, but they actually try to create networks of lasting friendship between them, so that they use host homes where there are children around, and they draw people together with the same people, the same driver, the same volunteer assistant. And what it does is it recreates a pattern of friendship in a person's life, which actually is more valuable than a cup of tea in a church hall, from which then they return to their comparative isolation. So I think the work that we do is just as important as the lobbying that we can do through CSAM.
Thanks. And what about the promotion of a living wage? Will you promote the living wage, for example, through ensuring that people who work for the church are paid a living wage?
Father Marcus, could you say that?
Yes, well, the major church institutions like the Bishops' Conference and its agencies have already indicated that they pay their employees the living wage, and we're encouraging all dioceses to, and have accepted this in principle, are moving towards that. Clearly, some dioceses, because of their own financial constraints, have to have a staged approach to that, but the aim is that within a relatively short time, all dioceses and their employees will be paid the living wage.